Good evening. You are listening to.
I just took a bite of an apple. I just took a bite of an apple.
There's no eating in the studio, Steve.
I'm hungry. I just flew away from Austin.
That's true. Okay, you're ruining the whole shtick. Okay, you are listening to the talking show on K-Chung Radio, the world's longest running. Show based in Chinatown, talk show based in Chinatown.
That's us.
Coming directly after Sativa Radio.
A new show, yeah. A brand new show.
Not an old show.
A new show.
Sparklingly new show, full of insights and uns music.
Finest uns.
Yeah, run by none other than DJ Max.
DJ Max.
But anyway, back to one of the oldest shows.
TJ Maxx.
my name is Nicholas Miller. I'm here as always with Stephen Cato.
Hello, I'm Steve Cato.
Tell us how you got here today, Steve.
By plane.
What kind of plane?
Spirit. Airline. I guess it was like a...
Airbus?
Airbus, probably, I think. Yeah. They're I don't
like
know the numbers.
European conglomerate, right? It's like France, Switzerland, and Germany or something?
Yeah. I think, you know, what's poetic about Spirit buying Airbus planes is it does feel like you're on the bus when you fly Spirit, as opposed to, you know, this, you know, you watch old movies or something like that, and air travel is glamorous or air travel is simple, and you feel that air travel is something different than taking the bus, but Airbus is like, we make Airbus.
Yeah.
It does what it says on the tin. It's a bus in the air.
It is not an auto bus. That is the four-legged bus.
Fun auf die Autobus.
Autobus. Yeah, who knows? You think does it mean it's just a terrible name.
Airbus?
Yeah.
Sure. I mean Boeing is like an unattractive sounding name, but at least it was like a Jeff Boeing or something like that, right? Who started Boeing? That's why it's called Boeing.
Maybe just the wrong industry, because I feel like Boeing would have been a great name for like a computer company in the early aughts.
They might have been in the 80s.
Boingo, wasn't that something?
Oh, yeah.
Before they started hacking away all the vowels, that was like kind of the style of tech company names.
Yeah, like during the early days of GoDaddy.
Yeah, GoDaddy. And now it'd be like...
GoDaddy would be a medium bad name for an airline manufacturing company.
Yeah. That name...
I flew in on a GoDaddy Z76.
Right.
Do you know... So here's a funny story about knowing about airplanes. Meredith and I, when I was in Seattle, Meredith and I went to the Boeing factory, which is the largest interior volume in the world.
Okay.
They have like a full assembly line, but for airplanes inside a building.
Yeah.
So you can imagine it's like an extremely large building.
Mm-hmm.
And the list of large buildings is fascinating. Like the compound that Ceausescu made for himself in Romania is the largest building in Europe.
Okay.
For example, also a fascinating building. Mm-hmm. But so this giant airplane factory that makes airplanes that then are the airplanes that crash, obviously, which is, you know, that have, inaccurate autopilot software.
Did they
make those airplanes there?
Did they switch the meters and inches? Is that what happened?
I don't know. but we're at the plant, and the plant's showing off all the new things that would be. The tour shows you all the new things that are going in the new airplanes. You know, like these cool LED polarized windows instead of window shades, etc. And a month or so later, Meredith and I are on a flight. And the other person sitting in our row, you know, is just like a yoga professional or something like that. And we're looking at the card and we look at the airplane and we're like, oh, this is one of those airplanes we saw in the
Boeing
factory.
Line, yeah.
It's got this cool window. Huh. And then we're talking about it a little bit with the lady sitting next to us. And then the lady sitting next to us believed that we were airplane fanatics. She's like, since you're really interested in airplanes, and we're like, we're not interested in airplanes. We just did one tour of the largest building in the world. We're actually building fanatics.
Oh, right.
We're interested in the large building, and it happened to make airplanes. She's like, oh, no, but as airplane fanatics, you'll appreciate this. And I'm like, we're not. She just wouldn't listen.
I see.
We were just pigeonholed immediately as airplane nuts.
Right.
Who are people who exist? No slur on them, but just it's not what we do.
Did you get classic defense? Did you go into child's pose?
I just screech and enter child's pose, yeah, and emit a loud hissing sound. And I rub my legs very vigorously against my thorax to create an unpleasant buzz.
Tuck your thighs in. Tuck your thighs in. You plain fanatic. You plain fanatic. Well, okay. We should. I mean, we have some pretty heavy hitters in here tonight, so we shouldn't keep them waiting. You know, as many of our dedicated fans will know, we've been taking a brief tour of toxic masculinity. And we'd like to frame this episode as a transition out of that. So we've invited one person to represent that side and one person to represent a path out. So tonight we have none other than Larry King and Sharon Stone.
We're in Larry's kitchen. He has one of these on the kitchen table.
Oh, stop it. Sharon Stone, one of the stars of an incredible movie, Lovelace. And I gotta tell you, I've known you for years. We've had a thing for years. Not that kind of, anyway, that movie comes on, you come on. Why did you don't look like you. You're a frumpy woman, you're playing her mother. You're a devout Christian. Explain why you took this role.
I mean, it's a great script. It's a great, great movie. It's a great, great directors. We have these wonderful two directors, two-time Oscar award-winning directors, Peabody award-winning directors, wonderful actors. Amanda Seyfried plays Linda Lovelace. Peter Skarsgård plays the kind of villainous boyfriend-come-husband. Just wonderful. I mean, it's just such an amazing opportunity to be in a great movie with great people.
But you're a glamorous star. You won Golden Globes. You're a great actor.
No, Larry, stop.
You drop dead gorgeous, and you knew that in this film, no one's going to say, "Boy, I want her." Right?
Well, and a lot of actresses. Some people like those kind of women.
A lot of actresses, Larry, would not have taken that.
Well, you know, I think that the thing to do is to take good parts with good people. I mean, it's not a vanity contest. It's an opportunity to play good parts.
Did you see pictures of the mother? Did you?
Yes, we did a lot of research. I mean, now you can go on the internet and find anything, really. So be careful, Larry.
She was like that? That's the way you put it? She was like that?
Yes, she was. I mean, we didn't try to impersonate her. We really just tried to capture the essence of the character, which I think that we did. And the directors were really... They were wonderful. You know, we tried all these different things. We tried prosthetic teeth. We tried fat suits. We tried all different kinds of things. And ultimately, they really encouraged me to just find the essence of her and to act it, not really to look for this gear to impersonate her. They really wanted me to find the truth of the character within.
Beautiful stars, we have a tendency to think are kind of narcissistic, and how do I look, and I have to go to beauty parlor for 2 hours. When you saw yourself, did you have any hesitancy about wanting to play this?
No, I mean, for me, when I started my career, I couldn't get the glamorous parts because people didn't think that I was sexy and they didn't think that I was beautiful enough. No, because I'm, as you know me a long time, I'm really a bookworm and I'm a shy person. And it was harder for me to pull myself together to get people to find me beautiful and sexy. And once I crossed that hump, then I got kind of pigeonholed into the beautiful, sexy parts because I really figured that out.
Basic instinct ruined.
Well, it
helped you and ruined you.
It helped me, but I got very, you know, I got into it and it was really fun. It was so fun for people to find me pretty and sexy and it was very flattering and I had such a good time with that. I think when you're 32 years old and suddenly everyone thinks you're the pretty girl, it's such a blast to be the pretty girl. And I really enjoyed it. And then I got kind of like, can I do anything else? And apparently, no. So it took a long time in my career to get to this point where I could play other things.
I just tweeted out, I saw about 7 episodes of you on Law & Order.
No. Oh.
God, you were terrific.
Oh, thank you.
That was an interesting character, that prosecutor.
Yeah, that was a good...
Did you play that a whole season?
No, I just did those episodes. But that was very intriguing to research. I went on drive arounds with the drug team, and we went out at night, and I got to do the whole thing with the bulletproof vests and the helmet and go with the guys on the drug raids with the dogs, which is just phenomenal. Those dogs are amazing. You know, when they bust down the doors, the dogs go in first, and the dogs can literally open cupboards, pull open the drawers, and they go through these buildings, and the dogs will indicate everywhere the drugs are. And then the team pulls out the drugs, they bring out the people and handcuff them on the streets. It's a fascinating thing.
Why did you take a television series? I mean, you were terrific. You were a hard-nosed prosecutor.
Well, as I said, I take the good parts.
And they were good parts.
And it was a good part. It was an interesting part. I had done Huff, which I thought was a fascinating show with an amazing cast. I'd done The Practice, which I won an Emmy for and really enjoyed that. Again, fabulous cast and great David Kelly, phenomenal writer. So it just depends. I mean, if it's good material, I'll do it. But, you know, not all the time for TV, but just when it's something quite good.
I knew Linda Lovelace, interviewed her. It's a tragic way she died, you know, and she got hit by a car, I think. Mm-hmm. She got to dislike the whole thing about Deep Throat and became against pornography later in life. Did you see Deep Throat?
I've never seen a pornographic film.
Notice the pause. Why, no interest?
No, it just doesn't really, has never really drawn me to it. Of course, when I'm in Europe, particularly Scandinavian countries, when you just change the channel, it's on regular television.
So I had to have seen it.
So I've seen pieces of it as I flip the channels, but it's funny to me. It's actually kind of silly.
But Deep Throat to me was a great pornographic film. I don't watch a lot of it, but Deep Throat. And it was funny.
That's what I heard, that it was funny.
Deep Throat was just packed him in. It was hysterical.
Right.
So you had, even after making a movie, you had no desire to see Deep Throat?
No.
The movie, though, says a lot more but just about pornography. It says a lot about domestic abuse.
Yes.
What she went through.
And I felt, particularly by playing her mom, that for me, that was the pull of the piece, that, you know, she had had a very difficult childhood herself, the mother. And I felt that in that period in the 70s, there wasn't what we have gleaned from women's rights and from human rights, the ability to come forth and talk about what's happened. There wasn't a language that women had to talk to each other, to talk to their children. There wasn't that kind of education. I feel that's one of the reasons why it is so important that we continue to hold on to our rights, our human rights and our rights as women, because these things are invaluable to raising children who are healthy and protected.
And you kind of disappeared for a while, right? I mean, you stopped making movies.
Well, I got married.
You got married.
I started raising children of my own. And as you know, I had a very severe stroke. I had a brain hemorrhage.
You nearly died.
Yes, I had a 9-day brain hemorrhage before they found out that I had a ruptured vertebral artery. And so I had a very long recovery from that. I had a couple years of a very difficult recovery.
You also had to go through the difficulty of losing custody of the boy, right?
Yes, because as I was recovering, my husband divorced me, married his girlfriend, and they sued me for custody of my son. And I wasn't really, I would say, certainly in retrospect, I wasn't strong enough and healthy enough to be in court several times fighting for custody.
I knew you
son.
During that period. It was a tough time.
It was a very difficult time.
And our little boys are born the same day,
yes.
Roland and Cannon, the same May 22nd. How old is he now? You see a lot of him?
He's 13, yes. I see a lot of him. And he spends all his summers and vacations and stuff with us. And we spent this summer in Italy with my 3 boys. Now I have 3. I adopted 2 other children on my own. So
how did you decide to, why'd you come back?
Well, of course, you know, it's my job and it's the job that I love. And as I became stronger and more well, and of course, you know, from my brain hemorrhage, I initially lost my short and some of my long-term memory. So I had to recover all of my brain functions. And it took time before I was really well enough to work consistently in film. Even when I did Law and Order, I was still struggling with my short-term memory to be able to be consistently powerful enough to work the long hours on the set.
Did you panic when you didn't remember things?
I wouldn't say that I panicked as much as I saw that I wasn't going to have a lot of compassion and care on a set. You have to be ready, and you have to be ready to work. You know, people don't have time for that.
Has Hollywood changed a lot since you started it?
Well, you know, we're in digital film. When I left working, we were still working on regular film, and now it's digital, so you have to be on it. You have to be fast, and you have to be ready.
Why? What is the difference? I'm not technical.
They just
all
continue to roll. There's not a lot of breaks and cuts and downtime, and it's faster to light, it's faster to shoot, it's faster to work, so you have to really be prompt and efficient and
movies
together.
It takes less time to do a movie?
Everything takes less time, movies and television, which is, of course, a blessing. All the
Wouldn't
waiting
like that?
Was,
yeah.
And we used to say they don't pay you to work, they pay you to wait.
And so you came back, but you've come back storming now. I mean, you must feel
it's
terrific.
It's great now. It's wonderful. And my kids are bigger now. You know, they're in school, they're doing well, everything's great. So
are you involved with anyone now?
None of your business, Mr. I've been married 15 times.
What do you mean, none of my business? Your business is our business.
Is it?
You belong to the public.
Do I?
Yes, you do. What's it like being a single parent?
You know, it's good. It's good. It's hard work, of course, and you never do it alone. You have to have a nanny, and you have to have a great one, which we do. We have a wonderful girl, Kathy, who's with us, and Katia, who comes in sometimes to help us. So I'm blessed to have great help.
How's your sister?
My sister, Kelly, is good, but as you know, my sister has lupus, and so we work with the Lupus Foundation, and that's been great because there's been breakthroughs in that area.
You've had a tough time of life a lot. You know, people see you as glamorous and all this kind of thing, but you've had some rough
edges.
Famous
people are regular people whose jobs have a great big window in the office. Everybody's just a normal person, you know, and I think people forget that. They think that famous people are somehow different or are immune from real life things, but we aren't. And so we go through our normal struggles like everyone else.
And we do fun things. We trick-or-treated together.
We trick-or-treated together many times.
We did. Mm-hmm. You've had miscarriages.
Yes.
You're a survivor, right?
Yes.
You get up off the floor.
Yeah, well, my philosophy is it's not how you fall, it's how you get up. And do you have the dignity and the courage and the integrity to get up and keep your moral compass together?
Did you find Sharon being as beautiful as you are?
Thank you.
That you intimidated guys? Did you have a sense that there were certain guys who hesitated about approaching you, figuring that she's...
Well, I do believe that everybody has to have a moral compass, not just me. And I think that people will use these excuses not to show up and not to be straight up, not to come with their plate, their side of the street clean. But I think
they lie to you.
Well, I wouldn't say that they lie to me. I think that there are great people, good people, and people that are, you know, perpetually immature. So there's takes all kinds.
Have you learned by this time how to spot them?
I would say sooner. I know sooner what is happening.
But you have
a little thing right there. Right, I got it.
We'll fix it. So you want to do that now?
Yeah, I think it's time. I think it's time for our ritual.
Oh.
There we go.
Oh, we got famous doing that, darling. Oh, yes. We did an event. You're still involved, but I did a couple of AMFAR events with you, one of which we had a great dance.
Yes, we've done well. And this year in Cannes, which was our 20th year anniversary in the Cannes in our AMFAR festival at the Cannes Film Festival in the south of France, we raised $34 million. And all of that goes to scientific research. And we've done so well. We had a pediatric cure in the last year. We've had adults who have now, through stem cell research, all of this has been through AMFAR funding, so we're very proud of our work. We're really getting somewhere now.
If memory serves me right, didn't Elizabeth Taylor get you into this?
Yes.
I remember.
It's been almost 20 years for me now as well, when Elizabeth couldn't come to Cannes, mm-hmm. and they asked me to fill in for her. And they asked me to fill in for one night, then they asked me to fill in for 3 years.
Why did you get so personally involved with AIDS?
Well, it just happened that way, and I think that it's where integrity meets opportunity. Through these years, I put on a hazmat suit in the beginning and looked at AIDS under a microscope. Then I started going to the research laboratories and meeting with scientists to become informed. Then I went to orphanages and spent a lot of time with babies whose parents had already died and spent holidays holding these kids. I spent a lot of time with moms who were dying of AIDS, who would die before their children. I spent a lot of time, I went to Camp Pendleton and spent time with Marines who were coming back from fighting in wars and through their injuries found out that they were HIV positive, some of whose families disowned them because even though they were valiant veterans, they would not take them home because they'd found out that they were gay. So through these very very profound experiences, I just continued to feel that there was a place for me to be of service. And as that need continued to be present, I felt that my fame had a purpose. And that sense of dignity, that sense of, you know, my faith really guided me. And, you know, it was very hard. There were years when I just felt buckled by...
Did you lose friends?
I lost a lot of work, I would say, that I didn't get hired for a long time. And during the Bush administration, you know, there wasn't a lot of support. We weren't supposed to say condom publicly, which was very disturbing to me. There was a lot of aggression. I didn't get any movie work for a long period of time. There was a lot of things that happened just because it was a controversial subject. And ultimately, we have, you know, AIDS is one, and HIV is one of the leading killers of women.
But we don't seem to hear a lot. Well, people think that now you live with it.
Well, you live longer and more productive lives. But we just don't have an available cure for AIDS. AIDS is still a death sentence. And AIDS is very prominent with young people. And we really still have to impress upon people the danger of HIV, and not just HIV, STDs. You know, there are a lot of very dangerous STDs. And I think that it's very, very important that we stress to people how important safe sex is.
Bono said, Bono's Red Foundation, 2010, 1,000 babies were born with HIV every day. In 2011, it was down to 900. He says that by 2015, the number could be zero.
It could be if we protect ourselves and we become as active and involved as we should be, and we get the governmental funding that we need, and we get the education that is so needed. Yes, it could be.
You brought in, I'm told this, maybe I hope it's correct, you brought in more than $50,000 for AMFAR just by kissing Kate Moss. In fact, you brought in $53,529 for locking lips at the gala in
We should also not say that I kiss Kate Moss. I think we should say that Kate offered this as an auction item. She's really a wonderful active participant in
raising. She offered up to kiss you.
Yeah, she offered her signature on an item. She offered to give things to AMFAR. She came to the event in Brazil. She's a terrific girl, and Kate is such an icon that people really wanted to see her on the stage. They wanted to see her donate items, and she is such a great sport. So, she kissed the guy gave this money. So she was such a terrific sport, yes.
Did you enjoy it?
Yeah. You know, yeah, but I could have fun in a phone booth, so I don't really, Sharon,
that you could. Are you still a Buddhist?
Of course, yeah.
What do you think happens when we depart?
You know, I can say we lost my dad going on 3 years ago in December, and I so clearly felt my father's presence for a long time after he died at my house. He died at our home. My dad beat esophageal cancer 7 years before he died, the unbeatable cancer. They gave him 3% chance of living 3 months. And he used both Eastern and Western medicine to beat the esophageal cancer. He meditated, and it was a wonderful situation. He had a tumor that was through the esophagus that was inoperable, and he meditated and visualized the tumor, and it went back inside the esophagus, and they were able to give him the surgery that saved his life. And he became a real active meditator through those years before he got cancer again 7 years later and died.
So you think he's somewhere now?
Well, I really felt him and heard him and feel his presence and feel him communicating with me. I do feel there's a very thin like membrane between us and the people who have passed over. Yeah, I just don't feel. I feel that when we leave the body, that the soul is ever present.
I hope you're right.
Mm-hmm. I do too.
One other question is asked on social media. Afsoon Zavil wants to know: are you happy with your life?
I am. I'm a happy person, but I believe that happiness is a discipline. I think that we choose happiness, and it's a lot like working out. You have to stay present with it and work with it and make decisions to be happy and let go of the negative.
You're as lovely as ever.
Thank you, Larry. It's good to see you.
We'll do it again. No, it's such a high. Eat your heart out. Sharon Stone, the movie is Lovelace, and you will love it and her.
That was impressive.
That's some talk. I mean, I guess both of those people really do this for a living.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
I feel like in Sharon's profession, she doesn't always have to talk.
It's part of the job, though.
Yeah, it's definitely a big part of the job. Yeah. Larry doesn't have to act.
Yeah, that's true. Or perhaps, you know, we don't know about his interior life. Maybe he only acts.
I see. So what would you surmise is Larry's true self?
Who could guess? The depths of the human psyche are vast.
Yeah.
He could be doing anything in his spare time.
He's like a vicious basketball fan, playing in an adult league and all sorts of stuff.
Do you see that shot of Bernie Sanders throwing free throws?
No.
There's this video on the internet of Sanders being like, this is before the heart attack. He's like, oh, I'm healthy, I'm fit.
Sinking him?
And he's just sitting there throwing free throws and sinking them.
But is it like a shot from in front of him and not the hoop, and then like a shot of it going in the hoop?
No. It's very poorly shot footage. It's just like him in some gym.
Oh, okay.
Like at some high school or some place where he was having a public meeting where people were like, and then my medical care cacked out, and now I'm going to commit suicide, like in one of those things. And then he sinks a bunch of baskets. I'm in very good health. There's also a picture of him doing it at like a carnival. It's his trick. He's like, he can throw baskets.
Right.
Anyway. So if Larry King does that, maybe he does it with Bernie Sanders. Get together.
Well, either way, his normally aggressive and offensive interview style was excellently rebuffed by Sharon Stone.
Yeah, for sure. Did I tell you I've met Sharon Stone?
Oh, really? Tell us about that. Obviously, we met her tonight.
Well, no, I mean, we've met before.
Yeah.
On the cold open for the Independent Spirit Awards, I was the prop master for that. And I
holy smokes.
Handed her a Zippo lighter.
What did she need the Zippo lighter for?
Part of it was she smoked.
Oh, okay.
In tribute to all of her roles as sort of like a sexy femme fatale.
I see.
She would sort of like light up a smoke.
Okay.
You know, in a way that was iconically sort of, and also sort of transgressive, right? Because like smoking is horribly transgressive at this point in culture.
Right. I mean, she probably doesn't smoke anymore because as we learn, her long break from acting was from a vicious brain hemorrhage that put her in the hospital for years. Yeah. And during that time, lost custody of her children. Lots of awful things happened, but Sharon's back.
Yeah.
Yeah. She's back in business. Did you see Basic Instinct when you were a kid?
I did.
What'd you think?
All right. I was too young to understand how it worked.
Like how those anatomies.
No. That part I got. I think I, it made me feel like appropriately horny at a, like a confusing stage of where that itself was its own kind of confusion. Yeah. But I think
this film hit for men of our generation. We all got hit about that moment with this film.
But I think that the, like I just didn't understand what was going on very clearly.
Oh, okay.
There was something about the way the film was made that was like maybe actually too formally complex for me.
Yeah, I recently rewatched it, and I mean, many of the threads are left open.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think, and I haven't seen it in a, I may not have seen it since like high school.
Okay.
Like where, did Joe Esterhaz write that movie?
It's a Paul Verhoeven directed film. I don't remember who wrote it.
But in like high school, friends of mine, I think, did like a, either, a, well, definitely watched many Verhoeven, but I think it was part of like an Esterhaz. If he did write it, if he didn't, then I'm confused. But
okay,
there's like a like the initial slashing scene at the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I have like some very strong memories of it, but I wonder from when.
I see.
Yeah, from at what point those were formed?
A testament to the way it's been lodged in your memory.
Yeah, exactly.
The amount of impact it had.
Yeah.
Have you seen Sliver?
No.
I feel like that was an erotic thriller written by Steve Cato.
I haven't. I remember the trailers for Sliver. Yeah. And I don't remember. It's funny because like there's some movies that I almost remember. I may have actually seen Sliver.
Mm-hmm.
Not remembered it, but I remember the trailers very clearly.
Yeah.
And I feel like there was a lot of Single White Females, another movie, for example, like another thriller, whose trailer I remember deeply and that I may or may not have seen.
Okay.
I guess it's a testament to the success of the ad company. more so than to my ability to like recall or enjoy cinema.
I see.
Maybe. Although I love movies, but you know.
Yeah.
How about you? So wait, you've been on a tour of 90s sexy thrillers.
Yep. Yep. A genre that seems to have been formed by Hitchcock a little bit earlier.
Yeah, but the 90s really ran with it.
Yeah, they took it and ran. And
do you have a theory why?
This is part of the research.
Okay.
Trying to figure
these
things out.
Where are you at?
I've been watching Sharon Stone's movies.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't seen Basic Instinct 2 yet, but I watched Basic Instinct and Sliver, okay, like back to back, basically. Sliver was amazing. I mean, it's a terrible movie,
okay,
in many respects, but it takes place in a really fancy postmodern apartment building in New York.
Yeah.
The owner of the building is
a Baldwin.
Yeah. The younger Baldwin.
Okay.
Not the most desirable of the Baldwins.
A Baldwin.
But a Baldwin, nonetheless. And he...
Which one is that? Bubub?
William.
Okay.
Bill. Bill Baldwin. You're presented with him. He's a very successful video game designer. Because also so much of, like, you know, rising electronics culture is in these movies. Like Disclosure with Demi Moore and... Michael Douglas. He's
What's the
a hard
of that?
They're in Seattle, and he works at like a very successful hardware computer company, and he's in charge of the hard drive division. The hard drive division.
Dang.
And there's a problem with the hard drive. And he exercises his frustration with the hard drive in various erotic fashions.
Wow.
But anyhow, in Sliver, it turns out...
That seems really unrealistic based on my experience being in Seattle, by the way. I don't think anyone... There's never been a less erotically intense conurbation than the greater Seattle area.
It's true. Another thing that's fascinating about all these 90s erotic thrillers is, you know, like the economic superpower at the moment was Japan.
Right.
Right. So then
the anxiety about the Japanese.
Exactly. Coming back, you know, attacking again or something, or, you know, financially dominating the West Coast. So in Sliver, it turns out he's not a computer game designer. He owns the building, and behind, you know, behind some false wall in his apartment, he has this like incredibly beautiful panopticon where he can surveil everything that everyone's doing. And it's designed by the Japanese, you know, and so he just, you know, well, I'll leave it for you to
those tricky celestials. What will they get up to next?
Yeah. But, we'll see. We'll see what this research yields. I think there'll be quite a bit of erotic thriller related content on the talking show in the coming weeks.
Have you gotten into like 90s Cronenberg?
Yeah, that spins the whole thing for
Crash
me.
And everything.
Yeah. But, you know, I recently rewatched Naked Lunch. Yeah. Not necessarily an erotic thriller.
Not sex parts.
Yeah.
But there's some sex parts.
I think of Cronenberg's stabs in that genre, Dead Ringers would be my favorite.
Dead Ringers, right. Yeah. His less phantasmagoric.
Sure, yeah.
More, you know, realistic, thrillery.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, like not like Rabid.
There's also...
That doesn't count.
Something that really blows my mind in these erotic thriller films is they all have like upper middle class jobs, you know, like hardware developer.
Yeah, yeah.
Or in Sliver, Sharon Stone is clearly a successful book editor in New York, you know.
Right.
But the workplace in these films is always like a refuge from the intense erotic fantasy life that they're living outside of work.
Oh, wow. That's cool. I've never thought about that.
Yeah, as like, you know, so things get really tense and complicated in the, you know, in the domestic space or someone else's domestic space.
Yeah.
But then work is like a severance from the stresses of erotic life.
Wow.
And just to see that like, and probably in the 90s, work was that way. You went to work, like maybe your partner could give you a call if like, you know, the kids were sick or something. Or like, but there wasn't like this constant contact and surveillance like we have today. So that... You know, obviously work has its own problems.
Right. Yeah.
But to see it as a refuge from something is really a fascinating way to cast working life.
That's really not how I ever think about it.
Not anymore. Not at all.
No.
So I don't know. That's one thing that's come from this.
Huh. And do you think that's just like a technological difference between now and the 90s? I.e. like at that point, you're in the more febrile form of the surveillance and state and mobile technology and such things, or do you think that that's to do with the way that like the Clintonite economy was working, or where would your guess go?
I mean, all good questions. I think trying to unravel the libidinal economy in which my sexual desires were derived is part of the project.
Right.
So I don't know. It's a good question. I know that the way that email is represented is fascinating.
Right.
Because I mean the characters get like an email. You know, like it's not just like some garbage platform for advertising.
Yeah. Essentially, the fire hose that you like occasionally hold like a tea strainer up to and try and like filter out a couple nuggets of like quality 30% off with free shipping deals on that one thing that you maybe really didn't even need to buy.
No, it's not that. Also, like computers are miserable to look at. You know, they're not
beautiful.
Yeah, they don't have like nice splash screens. They don't have nice graphics. It's like really chunky. Really chunky stuff.
I think this is betraying your professional bias.
Oh my gosh. Don't tell them. The workplace is my refuge from the talking show. Okay,
of making beautiful computer stuff, because it's like, you know, in some parts of computer use, like we had a former friend of the show, Solomon Bothwell.
Oh yeah.
For example, much of our conversation is about exactly such chunky UI.
Right.
And it's triumph. The glorying in like a similar visual pigsty. This is he scoffs at my ricing hobby, but I love to rice.
Right, make it look nice.
But like by making it look bad.
Oh, I see. Like the MSI Afterburner GPU controller.
I can't speak to what that.
I showed it to you the other day.
I mean, but this is radio.
Oh yeah, fair enough.
Did you guys get that? You guys know what that is? Sharon, yep. Larry, do you know what an MSI Afterburner GPU controller looks like? Just but yeah, you can definitely make your desktop look like that. That is considered Ooh. Very sick. Many people will upvote that Reddit post.
Okay. Well, thanks, Sharon.
Thank you.
Thanks, Larry.
I loved handing you that lighter that other day. I'm a big fan.
Yeah. We're both going to give Larry a little suspender slap. Or pull.
I'm going to give him a solid wedge. I'm going to yank those suspends all the way up.
Yeah. Yoink. Yeah. Forthcoming lawsuit.
And, well, you know, maybe not. Maybe that's what he gets up. Maybe maybe when you're like, what is the refuge from work?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that's actually where those erotics are contained.
Interesting.
In the suspends.
Well, good morning, Chinatown.
Ciao.